From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. He used to play straight arrows in B-films. Now he plays inept straight arrows in parodies of B-films. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Leslie Nielsen. Also today, Susan Lesser talks with us about her late father, Frank Lesser, the great songwriter who gave us the scores for Guys and Dolls and The Most Happy Fellow. She's just written a biography of him. And Kevin Whitehead reviews the new Arnold Schwarzenegger film, The Last Action Hero. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. The news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The Supreme Court ruled today that public school districts may provide sign language interpreters for deaf students in religious schools without violating the constitutionally mandated separation of church and state. NPR's Nina Totenberg reports.
The court's decision came under the federal statute guaranteeing youngsters with disabilities equal access to education. James Zobrist, a deaf youngster in Tucson, Arizona, attended public schools up until high school and always had a publicly funded sign language interpreter at his side. But when he transferred to a religious school in high school, the school district refused to pay for an interpreter, arguing that to do so would inescapably intertwine a publicly paid employee with conveying a religious message. James Zobrist's parents countered that paying for an interpreter was no different than if the school district had paid for a hearing aid. Chief Justice William Rehnquist wrote the majority opinion for himself and Justices Scalia, Thomas, Kennedy, and White. Today's ruling is precisely the kind of decision that could turn out differently next term when White, in all likelihood, is replaced by Ruth Bader Ginsburg. I'm Nina Totenberg at the Supreme Court.
The Air Force said today that a two-star general who spoke contemptuously of President Clinton has agreed to retire and accept a fine and a letter of reprimand. Major General Harold Campbell called the president a draft-dodging, pot-smoking, womanizing, and gay-loving commander-in-chief during a speech in the Netherlands last month. Campbell's punishment was first announced in a letter from General Merrill McPeak, the Air Force Chief of Staff, to Defense Secretary Les Aspin. Campbell could have been tried for the offense in a court-martial. The Associated Press quoted a Pentagon official as saying that General McPeak had wanted a far harsher punishment. The United Nations Security Council voted unanimously today to deploy 7,500 peacekeepers to protect six Muslim enclaves in Bosnia. Linda Fasulo reports from the UN.
After casting his vote, U.S. Deputy Representative Edward Walker called the new deployment an intermediate step that left open further action if Bosnian Serbs do not cooperate with the plan. The resolution authorizes 7,500 peacekeepers to protect six Muslim areas in Bosnia, including Sarajevo, Tuzla, and Bihać. Their mission is to deter attack, monitor a ceasefire, and promote withdrawal of Bosnian Serb forces. The peacekeepers would also occupy key points and protect humanitarian relief delivery and distribution. NATO has agreed to provide air power to protect the peacekeepers. The Security Council president said the deployment would be made in phases and that the UN has sufficient troop commitments to start the operation. For National Public Radio, this is Linda Fasulo at the UN.
On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrials lost 27 points to close at 3,495. This is NPR News. The Navy's highest admiral said today that proposed cuts in the number of Navy aircraft carriers could leave important parts of the world without a U.S. military presence. Admiral Frank Kelso, the chief of naval operations, said that he wants to keep the number of active aircraft carriers at 12 instead of the 10 proposed by the Pentagon. At least three people have been killed and 18 others wounded following a large explosion in a poor, densely populated Cairo suburb. From the Egyptian capital, Lori Neff reports.
The explosion reportedly rocked a crowded square in the Cairo suburb of Shubra, sending panicked people out into the streets of the impoverished neighborhood. Witnesses say the blast erupted near a bus station. Egypt's official Middle East news agency says it was the result of a time bomb. No one has claimed responsibility for the attack. However, it's similar to other attacks blamed on Islamic militants seeking to overthrow Egypt's secular government. At least seven people were killed when a time device exploded near Cairo's Central Railway Station in May. On June 8th, a bomb exploded near a tour bus headed for the Great Pyramids of Giza, killing two people and wounding 20 others, including five tourists. Three foreigners are among the more than 130 people killed in militant-related violence in Egypt since March of last year. For National Public Radio, I'm Laurie Neff in Cairo.
Two Detroit juries heard opening arguments today in the trial of three former police officers accused in the beating death of a black man. Malise Green, a 35-year-old unemployed steelworker, died last November after witnesses said he was beaten by police. Two juries were seated to hear the cases against two of the officers because one is expected to implicate the other. The judge in the case will decide the charges against the third officer, who's charged with assault. A county prosecutor told the jury that Green was unarmed when police beat him with flashlights outside a suspected crack house. The defense said that Green was resisting arrest. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Leslie Nielsen has become famous for parroting the kind of role he played for real during most of his career. Now he's best known as the incredibly stupid Lieutenant Frank Drebin in the cop film spoof Naked Gun. He first worked with the Naked Gun team on the disaster film parody Airplane, in which he played the doctor. Of course, he was in the real disaster film, The Poseidon Adventure. He's played more than his share of cops, pilots, and captains in his over 60 movies and hundreds of TV shows, including The New Breed, Forbidden Planet, and who can forget Tammy and the Bachelor. In his new book, The Naked Truth, Nielsen tells an uncensored, uninhibited, and totally made-up version of his life. Here's an excerpt of his audio version of the book.
I'm an extremely fortunate person. I've been honored by my colleagues with four Academy Award nominations. I've twice been named Best Actor. I've won two People's Choice Awards, a Golden Globe, a Best in Show at Westminster, an American League batting title. I've been a three-time finalist in the Publishers Clearinghouse sweepstakes. I was named Mr. Week of April 23rd on Home Shopping Network. And finally, in August 1990, I received the highest honor any actor could be given, other than participation in gross receipts. I was awarded the coveted Nobel Prize for Good Acting.
You've become famous for lampooning square, mediocre actors in B-movie formulas.
Yeah, well, it's not really becoming famous for lampooning those kind of actors. I'm really lampooning myself, and I'm pretty square. And I'm pretty dumb, and I'm pretty stupid, too.
Well, this all started for you with Airplane. How were you chosen as one of the actors in Airplane?
I think that David and Jerry Zucker and Jim Abrams, who were the authors and the creators, directors, etc. of Airplane, they had written something that was just wonderfully dumb and funny. And they knew that if Peter Graves and Lloyd Bridges and Robert Stack and myself, they had seen our work on television, and if we approached their material with the same seriousness and the same gravity with which we approached our police work television show that we were doing, that it would be very funny. And when I read the script, I knew exactly what they were after, and it was the greatest, advent or break of my life in a sense, but I ended up working with people who spotted me for being the closet comedian that I was. And from there came Police Squad and Naked Gun and on from there. And they just kept on. I was a closet comedian, and they kept on knocking on my door.
Had you ever done comedy before?
Well, yeah, I was always doing comedy behind the camera. And I had done one MASH maybe 5 or 6 years before Airplane, which was funny. It was called The Ring Banger. And it plays frequently, but the thing is that there was a episode in TV, and Airplane was a very successful motion picture, and it was significant enough that I did become seen and associated with comedy and with being able to do it. So it was the launching of the nut that is inside of Nielsen. Thank God for it.
What were the roles in your career that seemed closest to the kinds of roles that you've since parodied?
I think the body of my work. I think the new breed, for example. I began years ago when I would watch these police action dramas that I did, and I would sit there and watch myself and laugh uproariously at what I was doing. And then I began to laugh at my peers. I laughed at Robert Stack and The Untouchables, and it just all became so funny. And that's when I began laughing at the material in general. That's when I began slanting my eyes very strongly toward doing comedy. And I got lucky and had a chance to make that break.
Well, tell us about your role as the cop in The New Breed in 1961.
The New Breed, Lieutenant Adams. Adams seems to be a name that has pursued me. I played Commander Adams in Forbidden Planet. But the motto of the squadron was "No fat cops stealing apples." In other words, the true arrow, straight, stand-up cops on what they called the Metropolitan Squad, which is really an actual squad in the LAPD. So these were the guys, this squad, who were called upon to rush to whatever breach in the line there was, and they would function in every department.
Let's get to your role as the space commander in Forbidden Planet.
Okay.
Tell us about that role for people who haven't seen the movie.
The role? Forbidden Planet? It seems
everybody's seen Forbidden Planet.
It seems to play a couple of times a year, and it has for the last 35 years. It's amazing. And the story, it stands up today as well as it did back 35 years ago. But, another straight arrow. He was a commander of the spaceship, Bellerophon, and lands on Altair 4. It could have been the pilot for Star Trek. It was the forerunner of Captain Kirk and of Star Wars and all the science fiction films today.
You said that you used to do a lot of comedy behind the camera.
Yeah.
Did you satirize the films that you were in?
Sure. If they were, worth satirizing. I remember working with Bill Conrad when he was doing Canon. And so when you're working off camera or when an actor is having a close-up, you usually, if you're in the scene, you'll stand alongside of the camera and that the actor has somebody to look at and the actual person they're going to be working with or do work with in the scene. And I remember standing alongside the camera and Bill said, "What are you doing there?" I said, "Well, I'm just, professional courtesy. You don't want to talk to empty air." He says, "Are you kidding? That's where I put the prompter, the cards. I'm going to be looking at the cards there. I don't want you standing there." He says, "You don't think I spent any time memorizing this baloney, do you?" And so that was the attitude, that's the show. That's how he approached the show. That's how he did it. I know that any number of actors who use prompters that are around and don't bother to memorize the lines, there is a kind of sameness to many of them. I'm not putting that down, mind you, It's called product.
When you were playing the roles that you describe as the straight arrows in movies that you've described as not being very good, what kind of role were you dying to play?
I don't know. I don't think I really ever knew what kind of role. I know what kind of role I was dying to play. It's what I'm doing now in the comedy, Naked Gun. And I love comedy. Today in my career, I'm doing what I love to do, and that is do things for the fun, do comedy. It's a pleasure to go for the laughter.
What are some of the scenes that your fans quote most when they meet you?
Well, they quote lines from Naked Gun. I can't tell you how many times I've heard, "Well, surely you can take a step over here," or "Don't call me Shirley," or "Good luck to you. I want you to know we're all counting on you." And "Hospital, what is it?" These are punchline. Or "Well," or "Hey, Ernesto Palacio."
When you took on the role of Lieutenant Frank Drebin, did you actually? This isn't the kind of role where you'd understudy cops. This is the kind of role where you'd watch your old movies, right?
That's, yeah, right, sure, yeah.
Okay, what kinds of talks did you have with the director about what how to play it?
Well, you know, David Zucker, I used to say, discuss scenes with him, and he says, no, you just go ahead and do it. You're Frank Drebin. And I used to walk away. I wouldn't admit at that time to him that I was wondering what he meant, I'm Frank Drebin, because I was not Frank Drebin. I mean, I was Leslie Nielsen, and I went away, and I left that character in the studio when I went back. I was am a sophisticated man of the world, almost a Renaissance man. Frank Drebin is dumb and stupid. And I have now, through the last 2 or 3 years, come to realize that I'm just as dumb and stupid as Frank Drebin. As a matter of fact, Frank Drebin and I are together constantly now. But I had separated the two of us. And so now it's just, I'm just playing myself.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Leslie Nielsen, and he has a new book called The Naked Truth, His Uncensored, Uninhibited, and Totally Made-Up Life Story.
Yeah, I don't know where that came from because, you know, I think it's like infiltration from some other publishing firm because everything in this book is true except for the facts, and I've said that time and time again.
Right.
Yes.
Let's see what real biographical facts we can dig up. Many of your fans may not realize that A, you're from Canada,
yeah.
And B, your brother in Canada has been a member of Parliament and, I believe, Deputy Prime Minister as well?
That's true. And he finally came to his senses and, you know, just left politics. Thank God for that.
When did he leave?
About 2 or 3 years ago.
I guess you turned out real different, huh? He's also very conservative.
Well, he's a conservative politician, yes, but he's not, you know, dyed in the wool. It's a very strange kind of liberal or liberality that he does. I don't know. It's when you come from the north, close to the Arctic Circle, you are dealing with concerns and that have to do with people. That's all that counts up in the north because that's the only way you can get along with ice.
How far up north are you from?
Fort Norman is the place where I spent my childhood, and that is on the same parallel of latitude as Fairbanks in Alaska.
Brr.
It's pretty cold, you know. It gets 70 below zero.
So what kind of house did you live in?
Literally a log cabin. It was built out of logs. And in many cases up in the north, you find log cabins like that with the sod roof and the mud and straw and manure kind of plaster that's put in between the cracks of the logs and to use as a sealer, I guess, for the cabin itself. And in many cases, there was never a floor in the cabins. There was just that heavy, hard-packed gumbo clay, which was like cement, actually, when it was properly tended to.
Boy, you could have really given your children the lecture about, I grew up in a log cabin where I was cold all the time, and so on and so on.
Well, yeah, I suppose you can, but that becomes pretty boring to your kids. My father used to talk all the time about how he'd go out on the milk wagon when he lived in Denmark, and he would get the equivalent of 25 cents for a 10-hour day, and he'd bring the money back and give it to his mother. And so we reached the point where we'd hear this story several times, and you start to say, oh, my, isn't that nice? You had to pick your time to do that, incidentally, because you could end up flying across the room.
Right. Now, your father was in the Mounted Police.
That's right, yeah.
So have you ever thought about him while you were playing cop roles?
I did a 2-hour movie called Shadow Over Elveron. It was a small town sheriff who really ran the town and was quite a cruel man and very forceful. And I remember playing the role through, and my father saw it, and there was a telephone call. And he says, well, I saw the show. And I said, yeah. He says, well, I guess I know who you modeled that character after. And I was even walking the way he walked, you know. I just did everything the way I remembered he did. And so, yes, there have been certainly times that my experiences with the police work my father did, they came in very handy.
He wasn't cruel, was he?
No. It's hard to define being cruel because, you know, sometimes when you're living in that kind of austere climate up in the north, sometimes you really have to whack somebody pretty hard to bring them to their senses because if they don't do something, they're liable to freeze to death or die by some other mysterious means, you know. Sometimes you have to be very forceful to get your point home to keep somebody alive, literally.
So I don't imagine there were a whole lot of movie theaters where you grew up.
There were none. at all. You know, up in the, there were no churches and no schools either. That's how we had to come out of the north to go to school. My two older brothers were school age. I was still younger, or young enough not to go to school. And so we had to come south to find a place that had a school.
Where'd you go?
North of Edmonton, Alberta, Canada, a place called Thorhild. And they had a three-room schoolhouse.
And did they have any movie theaters?
No, but we had a guy who came by once a month, maybe. He'd drive in and put the sign up that there was going to be a movie at the community hall that was built while I was there, incidentally. And it would be on some day of that particular month. We might have gotten a film six times a year.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Leslie Nielsen, and he's written a new book called The Naked Truth, His Uncensored, Uninhibited, and Totally Made-Up Life Story.
Everything in it is the truth,
except the facts. We're going to take a short break, then we'll be back. This is Fresh Air. Actor Leslie Nielsen is my guest. His new book is called The Naked Truth. Well, I think your first break in show business was working on the radio.
In Calgary, Alberta, right, yeah. I wanted to be either an aeronautical engineer or a radio announcer.
Close.
And I don't know why I said engineer. I guess maybe I thought that was the thing to do. But I did become a radio announcer. Went to Lorne Greene's radio school eventually in Toronto and then down to New York City here, and
let's slow down so we could get the full impact of Lorne Greene's radio school in Canada. He had a radio school, he taught you what there?
He taught me announcing, Lorne Greene's Academy of Radio Arts, and and we took writing and directing and sound effects and all the things that have to pertain to radio. He had a very good school.
Well, did you feel provincial when you got to New York? You'd been in Toronto.
Provincial is not the word for it. I felt like a fish out of water. Uh-huh. I was not a hillbilly. I was a snowbilly, and I came down, you know, from a town. Thwart Norman had a dozen people. Thorhild had 75 people. This is what I was used to.
Oh, wow!
And you come to New York City. Yeah. I mean, the cosmopolitan city of the world, with guys coming up with wristwatches on their arms and flashing them and wanting to sell you and give you a good deal, and you know, you're the proverbial sucker born every minute. My only defense was that I looked like I knew what I was doing, and I looked like I belonged where I did belong, no matter how much I felt I didn't. And
were you consciously faking it, or did you just look
at it? Yeah, well, I know, I just shut up. You know, if you keep quiet and don't say anything, nobody can find out how dumb you are. And because I looked like I wasn't dumb. So that was my saving grace.
Now, I was surprised to read that you had also studied dance with Martha Graham when you went to
Well, that's part of the Neighborhood Playhouse.
Oh, I see.
They had Martha Graham was a friend of Mrs. Morgenthau, who I believe had founded the Playhouse. And so she was kind enough to teach us modern dance. I did not know who Martha Graham was.
You see, it just seems so out of character for me to think of all the airplane pilot and the cops that you've played, you know, doing modern dance with Martha Graham.
Well, I agree with you. I felt the same way. But the second year, it dawned on me, you know, who Martha Graham and dancing and so on. They had those kind of a blue jersey outfit they put on you with bell-bottom trousers and. And this was the kind of uniform you wore on any modern dance presentation. And, you know, I was used to cowboys and Indians and shoot 'em up and Tarzan and swinging from the trees, not this, running across with the piano music and doing hoppity-hippity and skippity-scoppity and so on. But the second year, I buckled down and really tried very hard to learn modern dance and to be part of it. And I'm very grateful that I did, too.
So you got to really like it.
Yes, I did. But also, you know, to have the benefit of being taught by such an extraordinary artist as Martha Graham.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, I didn't know anybody, and I didn't know about anything. So, as you said earlier, I had a lot of catching up to do.
When you look back on your career now, does it look completely different to you than it did before Naked Gun and Airplane?
Well, it's terribly different now. It's very different now. How can I put it? Things, fortunately for me, have not turned out to be as important as I used to think they were. My big break has not been, although Airplane, I think, was a break, meeting Jerry and David and Jim, but my big break began that very day that I woke up and decided I would no longer take myself seriously. And so,
and what day was that?
Well, it was a day, and I can't pin it down. It was 20 years ago, maybe, somewhere like that.
Oh, when you were still doing straight films?
Well, yeah, doing comedy, too. Well, doing straight films, yes, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. So when you say you decided not to take yourself seriously, did you think you'd been taking yourself too seriously?
Yes, I think so. You know, when you have important things to do, those, in many cases, are, I think, the way we defend ourselves against our feelings of insecurity.
Would you still like to do drama?
Sure. I do the one-man play, Darrow.
Oh, I didn't
realize
that.
The Life of Clarence Darrow, and I admire the man so much, and I love the play, and one day I will do it again. And also, one day down the line, I'd like to do Willie Loman in Death of a Salesman. But, you know, the disclaimer is that I don't have any ambition, and I do not have any goals, so I may not do them.
That's refreshing.
Yeah, right. I'm happy. You know, I like people, and I like hanging out with the people I love, and that's the name of the game for me right now. I hate avarice and greed, which includes people like stockbrokers, junk bonds, and things like that.
How did you do the condom scene in Naked Gun?
Very gently. You know what happened with that scene was that in the beginning we had a kind of a material on the condom that you could, you know, really kind of see through. It was translucent or not opaque, you know. And the scene didn't work. It just didn't. It was not funny. And eventually David figured it out, and he had them remake the condom, but so that you could see the outline, but you could not see anybody inside the condom. You could see the outline of the body and so on. And then it worked. And I think what happened when it didn't work was that people were spending a great deal of time trying to look through the condom to see Priscilla or to see whatever. And it was a very funny scene.
You want to describe the scene?
Describe the scene?
Yeah.
Well, you know, we have this wonderful candlelit dinner. And eventually it's apparent to Priscilla the enormous attraction she has for me as I for her. And we stand up and the clothes literally fall off our bodies as she says, "I believe in safe sex," and I say, "So do I." And the next scene, at the window in the bedroom, you see these shadowy images in an embrace, and you see these two giant condoms with the nipples on their heads as they maneuver and fall toward the bed. And the camera pans down, and you see something that looks like it's 3 feet by 3 feet, and it's obviously a giant condom package.
It's Leslie Nielsen, and he has a new book called The Naked Truth. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Hey, who are you?
I'm Lieutenant Frank Drebin, police squad. And don't ever let me catch you guys in America.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. The great songwriter Frank Lesser liked singers who were loud. Louder is better was his motto. So he didn't get along with Sinatra during the filming of Lesser's musical Guys and Dolls. Coming up, some behind-the-scenes stories from Frank Lesser's life, told by his daughter, Susan Lesser. She's written a biography of her late father. And jazz critic Kevin Whitehead goes to the movies. He reviews Arnold Schwarzenegger's The Last Action Hero. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. On Capitol Hill, the Senate Finance Committee has formally approved an economic plan that Democrats say will cut the nation's deficit by more than $500 billion. Republicans say, however, these figures are inflated. NPR's Brian Naylor has more on the story.
The Finance Committee approved the package on an 11-9 party line vote. Partisan feelings are high in the Senate over the proposal. Republicans on the committee complained about having been excluded from the budget-making process, and Senate Republican leader Robert Dole later charged the Democrats exaggerated the amount of spending cuts in the plan.
This is not a $508 billion deficit reduction package. It's about a $347 billion package. And of that amount, 260-some billion are taxes.
Senate Majority Leader George Mitchell counters that Republicans did not offer a single amendment to reduce spending in the package. The bickering will likely intensify when the full Senate takes up the plan, probably next Wednesday. This is Brian Naylor at the Capitol.
One commander of UN forces in Somalia says that the UN knows the whereabouts. A factional leader, General Mohamed Farah Adid, and that officials are waiting to arrest him. His arrest was ordered by the UN yesterday after attacks in the wake of an ambush on UN peacekeepers. Roger Herring of the BBC reports.
Admiral Jonathan Howe, the UN special representative here, refused to say if the general was in Mogadishu or if he knew where the general was. But the Pakistani commander, Brigadier Ikram al-Hassan, said his whereabouts had been pinpointed precisely. UN forces were simply waiting until he could be taken without risk to innocent civilians. Admiral Howe confirmed that he had instructed the UN forces not to disrupt their other operations to find General Adid, but he hoped the general would give himself up voluntarily. He regarded the general as a menace to public safety and wanted him in detention as soon as possible. Further details of the latest UN operation in Mogadishu have been emerging. Lieutenant Colonel Trevor Jones of the Australian Army said the idea had been to restore a safe environment in the city for humanitarian relief, and this had been completed successfully.
Roger Herring of the BBC reporting from Somalia. The Air Force has announced that the Air Force general who ridiculed President Clinton in a speech in Europe has been fined and reprimanded and will retire at the first of the month. Comments made by Major General Harold Campbell in a speech in the Netherlands last month have been under investigation by military authorities. The general received what is known in the military as non-judicial punishment, a step not as harsh as a formal court-martial. But top U.S. Air Force officials are quoted as saying that they did not want to make a martyr out of Campbell by giving him too strong a punishment. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down more than 27 points to close at 3,494.77 on volume of more than 294 million shares. Trading today was heavy. This is NPR News. By a 7-2 ruling, the U.S. Supreme Court has held that states that collected billions of dollars in unlawful taxes from retired federal workers must pay them back. In a case involving tax payments in the state of Virginia, the state Supreme Court first ruled that officials need not refund taxes collected between 1985 and 1989 under a now-defunct law. Virginia has since changed its income tax law and no longer exempts state and local government retirees' pensions. The state of Virginia now faces the possibility of having to pay refunds of nearly $500 million to some 200,000 retired federal workers, many of them former military people. President Clinton has announced a government crackdown on smuggling of illegal immigrants by organized crime. He also named Doris Meissner, a former Justice Department immigration official, to serve as Commissioner of the Immigration and Naturalization Service. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
At a ceremony today to nominate Meissner, the president also announced a new initiative developed by the National Security Council to stop the smuggling of illegal immigrants. The initiative follows a series of highly publicized incidents in which shiploads of illegal Chinese immigrants were intercepted trying to enter U.S. ports.
Alien smuggling is a shameful price of practice of unspeakable degradation and unspeakable exploitation.
The new plan will strengthen law enforcement efforts and call for congressional action to subject smugglers to stringent racketeering laws. Since August, authorities have documented organized crime activity in 14 boat smuggling incidents, the most recent a grounding off New York City of a freighter carrying 300 Chinese nationals. I'm Elizabeth Arnold at the White House.
An explosion in northern Cairo has killed at least 4 people. Over the last month, 3 bombings have killed 9 people and injured nearly 50 others in the city. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. The Broadway revivals of Guys and Dolls and The Most Happy Fella revived interest in the late songwriter Frank Lesser. Now we can learn more about him in a new biography written by his daughter Susan Lesser. It's called A Most Remarkable Fella. Susan is a freelance writer living in New Jersey. This is her first book. She's Frank Lesser's oldest child, born during his first marriage when he was living in Hollywood, writing songs for the movies. Before we meet Susan, let's hear Frank Lesser sing from the recently released CD of his demo recordings. This is Fugue for Tin Horns, which he wrote for Guys and Dolls.
I got the horse right here, her name is Paul Revere, and here's a guy that says if the weather's clear, can do, this guy says the horse can do, if he says the horse can do, can do, can do.
Are you crazy? I'm thinking Valentine, cause on the morning line, the guy has got him.
Susan Lesser, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Until recently, when your father's work was revived, were you ever frustrated that he hadn't been given his due?
Yes, I felt that it was too bad that people knew his music. In fact, you know, when I first started to write the book, I was one of my working titles was "He Wrote That Too."
Yes, exactly. Sure, this is a good chance to just like list a lot of the songs that he wrote that we would say he wrote that too.
Baby, it's cold outside. I'd like to get you on a slow boat to China. Praise the Lord and pass the ammunition. Roger Young. What are you doing New Year's Eve? Spring will be a little late this year. Standing on the corner. Big D. I believe in you. Wonderful Copenhagen. Once in love with Amy. Make a miracle. Fugue for Tin Horns. Luck be a lady. Sit down, you rock in the boat. Adelaide's Lament, which is probably known as a poison can develop a cold.
let me add to this, Two Sleepy People.
Two Sleepy People, right. Heart and Soul. Well, it just goes on and on. There are some funny, obscure ones, too. There's a song he wrote called I Get the Neck of the Chicken, and I Like Humpbacked Salmon.
I love some of the stories of Frank Lesser working with singers. Tell us a little bit about the audition for Guys and Dolls and what he had the singers do as they auditioned.
Oh, he had them yell for help. and they wouldn't understand what he meant. And he'd say, yell help. That's what I mean. He wanted to hear how loud they were. His motto was loud is good. He wanted the audience to hear every word and every note from every seat in the house. And he wanted no embellishments. He wanted his music sung note for note and loud.
In the movie version of Guys and Dolls, Frank Sinatra played the role of Nathan Detroit, and your father, the composer Frank Lesser, did not like what Sinatra was doing with Lesser's songs.
No, he didn't.
Why didn't he like it?
Well, Nathan Detroit is a very rough character, a Broadway character, and the original Nathan, Sam Levine, couldn't sing. He only had one song, Sue Me, and he came in wrong all the time on the first note. So my father had to write him a four-bar phrase, call a lawyer, and if you listen to it, I will not sing it. it slides up to the correct note to come in on. That was how bad Sam sang, but he was also brilliant and wonderful and rough and tough and runyonesque, whereas Frank Sinatra was very smooth and crooned his songs. And in fact, Goldwyn had my father write three more songs for Nathan in the movie, for Frank Sinatra. And my father would listen to Sinatra rehearse and would become angrier and angrier. And finally, they had it out, and my father kind of met his match with Frank Sinatra, who exploded about the same way my father did, both of them screaming words that I won't say on the radio. As it ended, Frank Sinatra, of course, performed the songs his way, and they never spoke again. They would see each other at parties and walk in separate directions. They would not speak.
You know what I think is interesting? If your father was so committed to big, loud singing, it's sure not the kind of singing he seemed to do himself, judging from the album of demo records that was recently released.
Well, I wonder if that's because they had to clean them up. They were very fuzzy.
Uh-huh.
He was definitely loud.
Uh-huh.
He performed with great gusto.
Did your father sing around the house a lot?
He sang when he was working on something. More often he played the piano,
mm-hmm.
working on songs. But yes, he sang too, and he and my mother worked out songs together. There are some wonderful old recordings of them singing Baby, It's Cold Outside and Make a Miracle from Where's Charlie?
Yeah, it's interesting. You write about how Baby, It's Cold Outside used to be your parents' song, and they would sing it at parties together until it was actually used in a film.
Right. And my mother adored that, because they would go to parties, and after the first time they sang the song, they were in great demand because it was such a wonderful, fun song, and they had such a good time singing it together, and they were very good performers of it. And so my mother felt it was her claim to fame at that time to perform the song at parties, and when he sold it to MGM for a movie called Neptune's Daughter with Esther Williams and Ricardo Montalban, it broke my mother's heart. She was very upset about losing the song. But then it won an Academy Award, so it made up for it.
After hearing your father sing on that Evening With album,
mm-hmm.
I assumed he was from an immigrant family of Jews in New York, probably Brooklyn, maybe Manhattan, probably the first in his family to finish school. And after reading your book, I found out this was not his background at all. Yeah, tell us what his background really was.
My father's father was a music teacher, a Prussian, who was very fearsome and very an intellectual snob, as was my father's mother, as was his half-brother Arthur. My father came from a family of intellectuals, musicologists, and people who felt that the route that my father chose to go was very low class and very unappealing. They were amused by him, and they didn't think much of him most of his life.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Susan Lesser. She's just written a biography of her father, the songwriter Frank Lesser, and he wrote the scores for Guys and Dolls, Most Happy Fella. And those are two shows that recently got revived on Broadway. We're going to take a short break. We'll be back. This is Fresh Air. Susan Lesser is my guest, and she's written a biography of her father, the songwriter Frank Lesser. Your life must have really changed dramatically when you were 12 and 13. That's when you moved to New York from Hollywood.
Yes.
Your father's show, Most Happy Fellow, opened on Broadway.
Mm-hmm.
And it was during that show that he fell in love with his second wife, Joe Sullivan.
Right.
And left your mother. And your mother was actually involved in introducing Joe Sullivan to Frank Lesser.
My mother did a lot of the casting for The Most Happy Fellow. She was co-producer with Kermit Bloomgarden. And when she heard Joe sing, she said, boy, this is a voice. This is a voice and a personality Frank would just love. So she sent Joe to audition for my father, sealing her fate. It was a very hard time for everybody. My brother and I were uprooted from our California suburban lifestyle and brought to New York City. We had visited but never lived here. I went to a new school. I was living with my mother. We were both, my brother and I, living with our mother and nurse in an apartment situation. We at first stayed with friends and then moved to a small apartment. My mother was not happy and was drinking more and more. And I had never lived in such close quarters with her before. And that was when I began to see that she had big problems. Everything changed for all of us. My father was living across Central Park in an apartment of his own and having his affair with Joe. And everybody was, he wasn't real happy either. It was a time full of turmoil. Although for him, I think it was mitigated a great deal by the great success of The Most Happy Fella. I think, you know, for him, that show was so important. He wrote not only the music and the lyrics, but he wrote the book. And he was involved day to day with every aspect of it. To Joe Anthony, the director's great consternation. My father attempted to direct it as well.
Well, you write that when your father left your mother, when your mother was 40, that your mother lost her man, her lifestyle, and her status.
Mm-hmm.
Did she ever recover from that?
No, she never did. She never did. She used to say that my father fired her because she had worked for him for so long. And that was all very funny and clever, but she never recovered. She never was reemployed by anyone. She tried to make it on her own as a producer. She had flop after flop. And eventually, she had terrible health problems, which were exacerbated by her drinking. And she died lonely and alone. It was a very sad life. She rejected the friends who didn't reject her in the beginning, the people who stayed with her, she one by one rejected them, threw them away, and was a very lonely, bitter person.
When you were growing up and still living in the same house with your father, did you ever eavesdrop on him while he was writing a song?
Well, I didn't really have to eavesdrop. He had a little organ in his room. And I would stop there on my way down to breakfast because he was a very early riser and he would already be deep at work, but I didn't see it as work. I didn't know what he was doing. He would be playing a phrase over and over again on the organ, and then he would get up and pace for a while, and then he'd sit in his chair and smoke 7 or 8 cigarettes and drink some more coffee and get up and play some more music, and I'd say, what are you doing? And he'd say, I'm working.
Right.
And, you know, that was another one of those surreal mysteries to me.
Is there any song that you feel particularly a part of because you were either with him while he was writing it, or you heard it ringing through the house, or he told you about it? Or
well, you know, actually, there are 3 songs. Thumbelina was one that he used to sing to me when he was working on the Hans Christian Andersen score.
This is the one that had the lyric "Thumbelina dance, Thumbelina sing."
Right, and he used to sing it to me, and I adored it. I was transfixed. I was 7 years old, I think. And he one day said, oh, I can write that. I can write that junk anytime. That's just a piece of junk, that song. And I was horrified to hear that. I couldn't believe it because it had meant so much to me. And then, you know, it was nominated for an Academy Award. It lost to High Noon. But so
what a weird competition.
Yes.
Thumbelina versus High Noon.
Really. And then I remember him working on Standing on the Corner, which is one of the few.
That's from Most Happy Fellow.
Yes. And it's one of the few songs that stand alone from the Most Happy Fellow that became popular hits. And I remember that phrase, the first phrase, over and over and over again. It must have been weeks, probably wasn't. It was probably a couple of days. But it seemed like the living room was ringing with the first two bars of Standing on the Corner for most of my 10th year or whatever it was, because it took him 5 years to write that show, so I don't know at what point he was writing it. But anyway. But the third song, that I think the song of his that means the most to me, is a very small, short song in Guys and Dolls, and it's called My Time of Day. And it's a poem, it's an ode to New York at 4 a.m. when the street lamps light the gutter with gold. It was a song that Skye Masterson sings to Sarah Brown, and it really characterizes my father, I think. I think that he liked that song the best in that show, and to me, that song is my father.
Well, Susan Lesser, it's been a pleasure to talk with you.
Well, thank you for having me.
Thank you for talking with us. Susan Lesser has written a biography of her father, Frank Lesser. It's called A Most Remarkable Fella.
My time of day is the dark time. A couple of deals before dawn, when the street belongs to the cop and the janitor with the mop, and the grocery clerks are all gone. When the smell of the rain-washed pavement comes up clean and fresh and cold, and the street lamp light fills a gutter with gold, that's my time of day. My time of day. And you're the only doll I've ever wanted to share it with me.
Peter Gallagher from the cast recording of the Broadway revival of Guys and Dolls. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel's with us. Robert, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Well, we'll be hearing from Nina Totenberg on today's Supreme Court ruling on church and state relations. Also, a report from Danny Zwerdling on the latest in Somalia, and an interview with Abdi Samatar, a Somali-born scholar of Somali geography and political economy. We'll be talking about Mohammed Aidid and what the background and likely future course of action of the Somali warlord is. Also, we'll be hearing from a reporter in Kiev about the latest summit between the Ukrainian and Russian presidents, and from a professor of violin in Tampa who, when his bow broke most recently, his $1,300 bow had to be rehaired, he went to the hardware store, bought parts totaling $6.50, and made what he says is a better bow.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Pinch-hitting film critic Kevin Whitehead says Hollywood has a long history of making movies that celebrate what they pretend to deplore. He says the latest example is the new Arnold Schwarzenegger movie Last Action Hero, which makes fun of contrived action pictures, but is itself such a picture. Even so, Kevin says, it has its points.
Advance word has it Last Action Hero is a real dog, but that's unfair. Any movie that has a dozen good laughs and a metaphysical premise can't be that bad. Its funniest bit is an imaginary preview for a Schwarzenegger version of Hamlet, in which the prince acts decisively for once. He beans somebody with the skull of poor Yorick and dynamites Elsinore Castle. Unfortunately, that scene turns up in the movie's first 10 minutes and unfairly raises your expectations. Nothing that follows measures up to it. In Last Action Hero, An unhappy New York kid named Danny, played by Austin O'Brien, is addicted to the Jack Slater action movies, starring Arnold Schwarzenegger as a tough L.A. cop. By a contrivance not worth going into, after watching the first couple of reels of Jack Slater 4, in which Jack looks for the killer of his favorite second cousin, Danny finds himself in the movie. Before long, he's assigned to be Slater's partner. Danny can't convince Jack he's a fictional character played by somebody named Arnold Schwarzenegger, but since Danny has seen the movie's beginning, he tells Jack just where to find the bad guys, to his skeptical partner's disgust.
You don't understand. You just solved the entire case. You just revolutionized the entire history of police training. I mean, all these years at the academy, studying human character, psyche of the terrorist, fingerprint analysis, all the courses that I've taken in surveillance, hostage negotiation, in criminal psychology. I mean, all I had to do is just drive around the neighborhood and point my finger at the house and say, the bad guys ain't there.
You think you're funny, don't you?
I know I am. I'm the famous comedian, Arnold Braunschweiger.
Schwarzenegger.
Gesundheit.
On one level, Last Action Hero is a parody of dumb, formulaic movies. Danny tries to convince Slater that he must be in a film because he has a kid for a partner and because everyone's phone number has a 555 exchange. Some of these in-jokes will go over the heads of the kids the movie is aimed at, but that's okay. As anyone weaned on Bullwinkle knows, kids like esoteric humor. It lets them know they're not being talked down to. But Last Action Hero wants to be a stupid action movie as well as a takeoff on one. Director John McTiernan, who also made Die Hard and Predator, lingers so long over the big stunt sequences, you know that's what he's really interested in. So the movie pulls in a few directions. The original script was reportedly more gritty and violent. Schwarzenegger, who served as executive producer, had it rewritten to lighten the mood. The movie was prepared and shot in a hurry to get it out in time for summer, and you get the feeling the screenplay was about one draft away from shootable condition. For the last act, Danny and Slater and their evil nemesis, played by Charles Dance, escape from the movie into the real world, turning up in New York's Times Square, and the contrast between movie violence and quote-unquote real-world violence is jarring. For a spoof, the movie has an unresolved undercurrent of nastiness, much of it targeted at Arnold Schwarzenegger, who toward the end of the film appears as himself at a movie premiere. We see his wife, Maria Shriver, lecture him about how tacky it is he's always plugging his restaurants in interviews, and then see her give him dirty looks as he does exactly that a minute later. Schwarzenegger even shares a scene with his fictional double, Jack Slater, who tells the star off. It's as if Schwarzenegger were using the movie to deal with some psychological problems of his own, or maybe it's Arnold the actor telling Schwarzenegger, the executive producer, something's not right here. That scene is creepy enough to be memorable, but it just makes you realize how conflicted this hurriedly made movie is. Like a dish pulled from the oven too soon, it's half-baked.
Kevin Whitehead is a critic and record annotator living in New York. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Joan Tuohy, with Sue Weinstein and Nancy Greenlease. Research assistance from Penny Nelson. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
McGarrigle. Their first two records have just been reissued. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.
Some say